The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com. Pretty pleasant day here in the Rogue Valley. Looking for a high about 90, about 90 or so. We'll be back to 100, 105 or so over the weekend. Been kind of a hot spell over the last few weeks. Certainly been the case out here in the West. The heat dome was here for quite some time. And it's good to pull back and get some perspective on what's been going on, not necessarily with the weather, but with the climate overall. And when I need to do that, I talk with Gregory Wrightstone. Gregory Wrightstone is a geologist, and he's been dealing with these kind of questions for years. He's the executive director of the CO2 Coalition in Arlington, Virginia. How are you doing this morning? Gregory, it's good to have you on.
Oh, good to talk with you again, Bill. Yeah.
Yeah. You wouldn't happen to have a tank of CO2 sitting by your bedside or whatever anytime you need to feel better.
No. But okay. My plants would love it. We know that's a huge driver of agricultural productivity and the greening of the earth. So, yeah, our unofficial motto here is we love CO2 and so should you.
Okay, that's good. Now, your book, of course, and I've read your book, it's a very convenient warming, how a modest warming and more CO2 are benefiting humanity. And you make a really strong case, and you go through here, and you talk about the history of mankind, which is usually a lot of misery when it's cool, and usually quite more prosperous when it's warm. I mean, it's something simple if you know get common sense side of climate here, but how have we gotten to be terrified of some warming in the world right now? What do you think?
Well, it's a very effective marketing scheme that they've got, and that's what it is. And they can tie just about anything to climate change. In fact, just last year, I had to laugh out loud. They tied increases in toenail fungus to climate change.
Really?
It's our fault because you got crappy toenails. Well, no, it's not. Not at all. They link everything to this supposed climate crisis. But if we actually look at it, and I explore that in my book, and at the CO2 Coalition, we've gone well beyond there is no climate crisis to not only is there not a climate crisis, but by almost every metric we look at, Earth's ecosystems are thriving and prospering, and humanity is benefiting from this combination of modest warming and more CO2. And let's just talk about that warming before we go any further.
Please.
Since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, global temperatures have increased some 1.2 degrees centigrade, which is not that much. But we're being warmed that it can't get to 1.5 degrees centigrade of warming, or it's going to be all over. Hmm. The end is nigh. Well, so what they're really warning us about, since it's already risen 1.2 degrees, is a 0.3 degree centigrade rise in temperature. That's half a degree Fahrenheit. That change, you can't even recognize that if you're sitting in your home, if it warmed or cooled by that much. It wouldn't trigger your thermostat. And that's what they're saying. We can't allow it to get half a degree Fahrenheit warmer. Well, my goodness, it warms more than that between 11 a.m. and noon almost every single day.
I guess where I would ask a few questions here is the increase in temperature and incredibly hot weather that we've been experiencing, mostly out in the West, but the East had it there for a while. Are these climate changes or isolated weather anomalies that sometimes come and go? In fact, I'll give you the Reverend David ended up sending me an email this morning, Greg, and said, Bill, I think these hot temps are a result of that undersea volcano in Indonesia a couple of years ago. I recall the scientists saying that we would feel the effects of it very quickly, and we would be seeing a temporary, like a jump in temperatures for a number of years. Is that kind of what you think is driving some of this right now? I know you're a geologist, but you are studying climate, and you look at things over a long period. What say you?
Yeah. Well, climate, volcanoes, we know that volcanoes do affect global climate. But usually it's a cooling effect. Explosive volcanoes on land put huge amounts of sulfates and aerosols into the high atmosphere, the stratosphere, that can be seen the cooling effect of that because the sunlight's reflecting off of it, so it doesn't get to the earth and it it prevents that much warming. But this last one you're referencing was the Hunga Tonga volcano. I think it was some 2 years ago that it actually erupted under the surface of the ocean, but near to the surface of the ocean. So when it erupted, it lifted just enormous amounts of water vapor into the atmosphere. And of course, water vapor is the greatest greenhouse gas by far. And I've seen some pretty compelling evidence that it's that increase in water vapor that has led to some unusual warming over the last 9 months or so, or a year, that's related to this volcano. It's nothing. You can't say it conclusively, but it sure looks that way. That could be driving some. So what that means then is, as that water vapor dissipates over the next months and years, we should see a lessening in temperatures, a little bit of a cooling.
Does that water vapor end up falling back down to the planet as rain, or does it?
Yes.
Okay, so it does stay with us. Okay, all right.
But it'll probably take a while. By a while, it might be a couple of years before it finally gets back to what it was before. But again, we don't know. There's nothing conclusive. There's a lot of evidence, circumstantial evidence that's pointing to this. And that's quite unusual. This was a hugely unusual volcano. Volcanoes that go off all the time all over the Earth, but most of them that are in the ocean are way deep, and you don't know about it. This one was close enough to the surface that it erupted. When it erupted, it lifted huge volumes of water.
It was essentially like it was boiling the ocean at the surface, and all of this steam and dust up into the stratosphere, right? That kind of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
And so, you know, and we see what I look at too when we look around the. We're doing state and regional studies, and we find that for most of the north of North America, and actually Europe, the 20s and 30s were by far the hottest that we've experienced. Most of the heat records were set some 90 years ago, not today. And of course, 90 years ago, the CO2 levels were very, very low compared to what they are today. And they're still low today's, so we think that more CO2 would even be more beneficial to the Earth, and because it has such a small amount of warming effect.
400 parts per million is where we are right about now, right?
Yeah, 420-ish in that range.
All right.
And but bear in mind, that's looking at it from a geologist, it's actually near historically low levels of carbon dioxide. Throughout Earth's history, it averaged 6.5 times that, 2,600 parts per million. And so these levels today are still much lower than what plant life could reach their maximum growth potential. So we even more CO2 would be benefit. The plants, they don't have a say in the matter, but if they could, they'd be voting for more CO2.
Is there any evidence, because I know that this is something that the Greens, or maybe I shouldn't even call them the Greens, Gregory, but people who are looking to leverage everything about so-called climate change for political power. In fact, I almost look at the climate change cult, Gregory, as almost the modern day version of the witch doctor, in which all you have to do is send us lots of gifts, lots of money, lots of taxpayer money, and we're going to do a dance of some sort, and we're going to change the weather. I mean, there's a little bit of truth to that, you know, the way it's being presented these days. But is there any evidence that natural CO2 from coming out of a peat bog or a glacier that's warming or whatever it is treated differently out in the world than CO2 coming from, I don't know, your gas stove or your propane stove or your car or anything else? What do you know?
Well, the fact of the matter is we've been in a 140 million year decline in how much CO2 is in the atmosphere. And so it's been almost a linear decline of carbon dioxide ended to near historically low levels at the end of the last ice age. It got to what I call the line of death, below which plant life can't survive. So what we've been doing since the end of the last ice age, and particularly since the middle of the 20th century, when we started adding a lot of CO2 to the atmosphere via burning and use of fossil fuels, and so we're still not at levels of CO2 that are optimum for plant life, but it's certainly at 400 parts per million, it's certainly a lot better than what it was 150 and 200 years ago.
What is the optimum CO2 level for maximum plant life, or for good plant life, let's say?
Well, we know that we see more CO2 will continue huge increases in plant growth. It looks like somewhere around 1,000, a little bit above. Now, even more CO2 above that would also increase plant growth, but not at the same rate. At this rate, plant life needs more CO2. And usually, if you look at greenhouses, and I know out where you are, there are a lot of marijuana greenhouses.
Yes, there are.
What they do. Yeah. And so these marijuana greenhouses and regular greenhouses actually have CO2 canisters that they add to the greenhouses. And they like to get the levels up around 1,000. If they took it to 2,000, it would be even better. But it's a matter of economics. Once you get it to 1,000, it costs you a lot more to get it up even further. So there's a break-even point, you know, with cost-benefit analysis of marijuana and CO2, or even, you know, if you're growing tomatoes or cucumbers.
Yeah, well, you'd have to figure, though, that if marijuana grows better at 1,000 parts per million, then that would mean that wheat would grow better. That would mean trees would grow better. That would mean that all of our agriculture would grow better, too, right?
And we're seeing that. Now, bear in mind, too, if a greenhouse, they need to either, of course, they need screening up to keep, but most of these are enclosed because they don't want other types of marijuana polluting or whatever they are,
cross-pollinating it, sure.
So what you have are these closed greenhouses, and what you have to do, you have to add CO2 or some ventilation to bring in filtered air from outside, because in an enclosed greenhouse, no matter what you're growing, the plants are just sucking CO2 right and left out of the atmosphere. So your CO2 levels in the greenhouse can drop down to 200 parts per million, 220, very low levels that inhibit plant growth. So for best plant growth, you need to keep either bring in filtered air with ambient CO2 or use these CO2 canisters to get that CO2 level up. Otherwise, the plants will be sucking it all. And we see that, you can see that in a cornfield when it's in a calm day with no wind. And if you take a CO2 meter, which I have, and you can.
Of course you do.
Along the road.
Of course you do. You're the CO2 coalition. Of course you're going to have a CO2 meter. That cracks me up, Gregory. But hey, please continue.
Yeah, but if you walk, and I've done this, if you're away from the cornfield, it might be at 420 or 390, whatever it might be. It's around 400 is the ambient levels. Walk into that cornfield, go in 20, 40 feet into the cornfield, and the CO2 levels in the cornfield are significantly less because what's going on? Photosynthesis. What do we need for crop growth? Water, sunlight, and CO2, and the more CO2, the better. So it's a natural phenomenon, this removal of CO2 by plants. And we're seeing that documented. We know pretty clearly what the CO2 emissions are from humans, from burning of fossil fuels. We know that pretty clearly, and only half of it is showing up in the atmosphere. Well, why is that? That's because the other half of our emissions are being what's called sequestered. It's being removed from the atmosphere because of enhanced photosynthesis.
Plants.
And so it's actually plants, right? Plants and using photosynthesis that's being turbocharged by the CO2 is locking that CO2 up in whatever the plants are. And again, we see this from the near pole regions to the equator, this increase in plant growth. That's a good thing, isn't it? I think it's a really good thing, especially when we look at agriculture and agricultural production. So this is something we should celebrate, not demonize.
Is there a case to make, though, that when you don't have as many deer or grazing on the land as you once had, the increase in CO2 also would cause increased grass growth, wouldn't it, naturally? out here on the West Coast?
And what you're seeing on the West Coast is one of the problems with fire you have there is, well, there are a number of things we can talk about fire, but one of the really big problems is this introduction of cheatgrass, which is a non-native species that it's called cheatgrass because it comes out and sprouts earlier in the spring than regular, and it kind of takes over. And a lot of the big fires we've seen in the West have been actually grass fires because this grass might grow up, might be a foot and a half high, and it can dry out with a strong dry wind. It can dry out after a rainstorm within a matter of hours. If you look at these Santa Ana winds, the Diablo winds of California, these winds can come in. They're hot, dry, and as they sweep down, just any spark will set this cheatgrass off. It's kind of like those of us that were Boy Scouts, we know how to build a fire. You have to start it with something like tiny kindling, and that's what this cheatgrass is. Some of the big fires of California were actually not forest fires, but rather grass fires.
But you see, that's what I'm getting at, though, is that this is not a carbon. This is not a climate change carbon dioxide induced fire. This is things are growing more, but then you have the wrong stuff growing, and you're not doing anything about that. It's pretty difficult.
And we see that globally. The Copernicus satellite went up in 1983, and for the first time we were able to assess global fire on an acreage burnt area basis. And we've seen since that Copernicus satellite went up, there's been a really significant decline in the area burned since that satellite went up. It's a pretty significant decrease globally. And they'll show you charts in the United States and the lower continental 48 states of this huge increase in number and area burned. Well, yes, has there been an increase? And they start that also. Their chart starts in 1983. And that's when we started this, really the forest management of our forests changed during that period, is that when they started worrying about the spotted owl and stuff.
Well, it's when we stopped doing much harvesting, and Mother Nature is going to harvest one way or the other. That's just fact of life, you know. Yeah, if you're not managing it. We're talking about CO2 with Gregory Wrightstone once again, and he's the geologist and executive director of the CO2 Coalition in Virginia, and his best-selling book is A Very Convenient Warming: How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. And it's a really interesting read. I can't say enough good things about it because you back it up with data. It's not just your opinion. And so you're saying, you know, let's not get all, not have heart attacks over carbon dioxide, as you have so eloquently pointed out this morning. I guess where I'm going to go here is talk a little bit of politics here before we maybe take a call or two, Gregory. And it has to do with the climate change and CO2 policies of the two presidential candidates. It looks to me like Kamala Harris is one of the people who is really, really pushing controlling this and trying to tamp it down somehow, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, she's walking back from some of her past policies. We know that when she was running for president, she absolutely positively promoted a ban on fracking. And just think about just that by itself, because of fracking and its combination with horizontal drilling, that's why the United States is now the global leader in production of oil and natural gas. It's because of fracking. Hmm. And she wanted to stop that. She's also part of the Biden agenda that's really done everything they can to inhibit American oil production. Thankfully, though, this shale gas revolution that's using fracking is almost entirely, virtually everything is on private property. So it's harder for the federal government to inhibit that production and that development of those private resources. But they have stopped where they could federal lands, halted lease sales in the Gulf of Mexico, which is about 10% of our oil production comes from offshore in the Gulf of Mexico. They've actually shut down now our Alaska leasing and rolled that back. And that's going to have long-term implications if it continues, because the Prudhoe Bay, the Alaska pipeline, Trans-Alaska Pipeline coming south out of Prudhoe Bay is nearing its economic limit, mm-hmm. and they really need more oil production to get it up. At some point in the future, it will become uneconomic to operate that pipeline, and that when they shut it down because of that, all that remaining oil is stranded forever. There won't be another Alaska pipeline like that.
Undoubtedly, though, that's considered not a bug but a feature of the plan, of what you've been talking about. Hey, is there any sense at all to the plan that we've been reading about in the Midwest to sequester carbon, to take carbon dioxide out of the air and pump it underground and store it there forever? Is there any sense in that? What does that do?
Not one bit. In fact, we just published a paper on Wyoming. The governor there, Mark Gordon, is along with other Western governors, Kristi Noem, Doug Burgum. They're all on board with carbon capture and sequestration. They want to decarbonize the West.
Really?
It's completely does not make any sense. And our paper on Wyoming, we fought them there, spoke in Wyoming, and the title of our paper was Wyoming and Climate Change, CO2 Should Be Celebrated, Not Captured. And that's the gist of what we were talking about there. In fact, I traveled to Wyoming earlier this year along with Dr. William Happer and Dr. William Sapoya, and we testified before the Senate Ag Committee. A week after we testified in Wyoming, the Senate voted 16-15 to strip Governor Gordon of $357 million from his green energy slush fund. And Senator Steinmetz, actually, she came on board and credited the work that we did as allowing them to confidently do this, because she knew that there's no climate crisis. So we at the CO2 Coalition, we're working hard to protect the states from overregulation through the EPA, Department of Transportation, and others.
I would figure that President Trump would have a lighter touch on such matters, but is there a lot of the EPA that is still pretty much running wild, making up its own rules as it goes along here?
Yeah, and one of the problems I think that he had first, he didn't realize how deep the deep state went. He didn't clean house like needed to be done. These people at the EPA, Department of Transportation, the Department of Energy under Jennifer Granholm, these are populated. These people love regulations. They love control. They want to control every aspect of your life and your listener's life. They want to control what you drive, how you heat your home, how much water you use from your toilet and your shower. Every aspect of your life they want to control. And I was going to say, I just don't get it, but I guess I do. They think the government knows best.
Well, it is the lifeblood of
one of your listeners.
Well, I know the lifeblood of a bureaucracy is the ability to have the power to, move people, move agendas. That's it. Talking with Gregory Wrightstone once again, and his book is A Very Convenient Warming, How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. Grab a call here before you take off here. Someone's been holding on here for a while. I don't know who you are, but hopefully you make some sense. Who's this? Good morning.
Hi, this is Margaret in Central Point.
Hello, Margaret.
Hi. As soon as you mention a book and the author, I always go to the library and see if they have it. And I checked our Jackson County Library. They don't have Mr. Wrightstone's book, but I need the copyright year so I can put in a request for them to purchase it. So can you give me that, and then I'm going to enter that into the library system and see what happens.
Okay. What's the copyright year of this? I could look up on mine here. I think it's 2023. Okay. There you go.
Yeah. Okay, I'll put that in there. And thank you. I just want to say, Bill, that you're such a treasure for us here in Southern Oregon, and I just so much appreciate you and your program and all the CO2 Coalition is doing as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Margaret. There you go.
Good luck finding that in your library. My home library, my first book was a number one bestseller on Amazon, and my home library that I could walk to refused to stock it. And they said it was science denialism and they weren't going to have it in the library. So,
in other words, there you are, the scientist, right? The scientist deny, and they accuse you of denying science. Oh, just irritates me. You know something, Gregory? I've been talking about this off and on. There's a friend of mine that talks about the modern-day library, the public library, as constituted by the American Library Association, is like a liberal mosque in which all it is a political outpost. The fact that you have trouble getting these books in there, I wonder if we should just buy the books and donate them to the library. Maybe that's how we should go about this. What do you think?
I've already done that. They sent them all back to me.
Really?
And in fact, the head of the library, it was embarrassing for me, but she attended our church and they sat two pews in front of me and I blasted her because of the censorship, modern day censorship. She didn't like that very much, but too bad. You know, this is the modern day censorship that we're seeing. But you know what, Bill? They need to censor me and my colleagues here at the CO2 Coalition, because what we say is we make a very compelling case that's fact and science-based, that there is no climate crisis, that warming and more CO2 are hugely beneficial. If they allow us to get out in the mainstream media and provide the truth, the facts, and the data about this benefits that we're seeing from climate change, it'll be game over for the climate crisis crowd. They have to silence us.
And I think also the other side of this that you can't ignore, Gregory, is that, as the Asians would say, a lot of rice bowls are broken if your information becomes more widely disseminated and people understand this. Because when I talk about the rice bowls, it's the huge government and multinational corporate grift that is all about pushing this agenda, the climate change agenda from CO2, right? That kind of thing. Everything.
Yeah. Climate grifters. That's a good description. They're standing there with their hands out. We're seeing that in the Pacific, Caribbean, Indian Ocean nations like Maldives. These islands are claiming that they need climate reparations on the order of tens of billions of dollars because they're going to be underwater soon. Well, you know what? That, for example, the Maldives, all these islands, 15,000 years ago, were just above sea level, just as they are today. In the last 15,000 years, sea level's risen 400 feet. 400 feet of sea level rise. Why aren't they under 400 feet of water? It's because of a geologic process called accretion. These islands actually grow as sea level rises. It's a natural. The storms wash these gravels and sands during storms up onto the island, and then that's distributed by the crabs and critters of all sorts.
I didn't know that.
These islands.
You know,
yeah,
all
isn't that fascinating?
All these years I've been talking with you, and the accretion part I did not know. But, of course, you're a geologist, right? This is your wheelhouse.
Yeah.
You get that. Okay.
But this is what they're talking about. And they're saying we're going to be underwater by 2050. At the sea level rise rate we are today, by 2050 it's going to rise another, I hope you're sitting down, 2 inches. Okay? So what they're telling you is that, you know, the last 400 feet of sea level rise didn't put those islands underwater, but that next 2 inches,
that's
look out,
it.
They're
that's
be
it.
Underwater.
Yep. They'll be, oh, man. You have to put the entire island on stilts. Gregory, great talk as always. Thank you so much. And a very convenient warming, how modest warming and more CO2 are benefiting humanity. Gregory Wrightstone, geologist, executive director of the CO2 Coalition. We'll definitely have you back. And thanks for the good news. Okay. Be well. Take care.
Thank you very much.
738 KMED KBXG.
Looking for reliable roofing experts? Turn to the family-owned gem of our community, Stephen Westfall Roofing, Inc., your go-to for metal roofing solutions, offering 25-year workmanship guarantee on all projects. New construction, re-roofing project, residential or commercial, they've got you covered. This experienced team ensures a stress-free experience from start to finish. Choose quality. Choose Stephen Westfall Roofing, Inc. for your metal roofing needs. Call today. Get an estimate tomorrow, 541-941-3736.
Summer will be over in a flash, and to celebrate, Grange Co-op is having our largest clearance sale of the year, July 27th through August 4th. You'll find 50% off all clearance items throughout the store. Just look for our clearance signs in departments like Farm and Ranch, Garden, Home, Pet, and even on our most popular apparel brands. So hurry into Grange Co-op for our 50% off clearance sale, July 27th through August 4th. Grange Co-op, achieving more together.
It's the Bill Myers Show on KMED, Southern Oregon's place to talk.
And Francine, of course she wants to talk. How are you doing this morning, Francine?
Of course. I'm doing well this morning.
Good. Bill. Glad to hear it. What's up?
I listened to some music this weekend, and I can't remember. It might have been, you know, JPR or something for a little bit. I think they have a really good bluegrass mm-hmm. thing for a couple of hours. And they have an ad going over and over and over again about how our water is disappearing. We have to save our precious resource and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And here this gentleman was talking about the rising oceans. I mean, from everything I have read and understand, basically the amount of water that exists on the earth is probably never going to change because we have an atmosphere which, you know, there's evaporation, then it all comes down again.
People as rain.
Drink water,
yeah.
Pee it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you water your garden, the water goes down into the water table again. I mean, I think water is just a constant circulation of the resource.
Yeah, and maybe what they're speaking of when the do-gooders on JPR or whatever it is that you were, you know, listening to, and maybe what they're thinking of is the availability of, or the easy availability of fresh water. Maybe that has to do with what they're talking about. I don't know, because there's a case to be made that that out here on the West, especially in the Northwest, that we might be going into a drier time, and that we settled the West in a time which we had considerably more natural rainfall. And there may be a case to be made on something like that. Maybe that's what they're talking about. So the idea is that you should be using one square of toilet paper like Sheryl Crow was talking about. Sheryl Crow was on the bumper rotation. It was a perfect time to bring her up, right? You know, she was there.
Oh,
so one square of toilet paper. It better be really thick toilet paper, that one square. But
I'm telling you. Well, you know, I think there could be a point made for different locations can access the water better at certain times, and
yeah.
There's less for them to access. But the amount of water on the planet, I don't believe that really can change. And I would really be interested in someone who has some knowledge about this to hear what they have to say.
I'll see if I can find someone. I'm not that individual. Of course, you know, water will get locked up in the in glaciers, depending on what happens,
yeah,
and then it's getting released. Right now, if there's some warming that goes on and other glaciers grow, and I guess perhaps the other way of looking at this is that water from rainfall doesn't get evenly distributed too, because you know you'll read the stories as we're sitting here in drought out on the West Coast. You'll see other areas of the country and also other areas of the world that are just being pounded with rainstorms right now, right?
Yeah, but I mean they keep taking our resources and redoing them in ways where they can channel the resources to where they want it to go. You know, mm-hmm. like remember the guests you had, they were cutting down all the Joshua trees to put a solar array up.
Exactly.
You know, that kind of thing. And then power was going to go where? Not to the people out there in the desert. It was going to go down to what? Was it somewhere in L.A.? I can't remember.
I'm pretty sure it was L.A. It was out in the L.A. area that needing it. Yeah. Point well taken there, Francine. I'll see if I can actually find out what the state of water is. But we know that it's very
a really interesting segment to have on the show.
Yeah, it's very very precious resource here, especially out in a relatively arid West. The West has always been arid, as in the grand scheme of things. Los Angeles wouldn't be in existence if they had not been able to pipe the Colorado River there. There's just no way.
I understand, but then the people in Colorado don't have the water that should be in their state.
Yeah, well, water rights. Water rights are worth fighting for. It's 744. Herman joins me here in just a moment, too. This is the Bill Myers Show.
News is sponsored by Millett Construction, specializing in foundation repair and replacement. Get on solid ground by visiting MilletteConstruction.com.
From the KMED News Center, here's what's going on. A new statewide coalition of environmentalists want to add an environmental rights amendment to the Oregon Constitution, enshrining the right to a healthy environment in the Bill of Rights. Proponents say healthy environment rights is key in the era of human-made climate change. Opponents say an amendment would make lawfare easier for environmentalists, essentially allowing them to control all land use in the state. The Oregon Department of Forestry said Monday it's ordered crews through the Oregon National Guard to contain and help put out over 100 wildfires across the state, several that have grown to megafire status of over 100,000 acres. Your tax dollars at work. The Measure 110 hotline costs the state $130,000 a month to run. According to the Oregon Health Authority, this year the hotline received 73 calls from people with Measure 110 citations, translating into about $10,700 per call. Bill London, KMED News.
This hour of the Bill Meyer Show is proudly sponsored by Phoenix Auto Center Tire Pros on Main Street in Phoenix.
Hi, it's Jolene with Phoenix Auto Center Tire Pros. We've got summer savings on quality Continental tires. Through August, get a $110 Visa prepaid card in the mail when you purchase a set of qualifying tires for your truck, SUV, or van. And there's 16 different popular styles to choose from, including Cross Contact, 4x4 Contact, Terrain Contact, and Premium Contact. Continental is one of our most recommended tire brands, so if you need a set for your truck, SUV, or van, come see us at Phoenix Auto Center Tire Pros in Phoenix.
Rock This Town by Stray Cats was released in 1981 and peaked at number 9 on the singles chart. Millette Construction can relate to this song because we rock your town one building at a time by firming up and solidifying foundations, leveling floors, and fixing the water problems that cause instability. So don't let those cracks in walls make you scream and shout. Millette will rock your place inside out. Visit MilletteConstruction.com. By the way, Stray Cats may look and sound like they're from the UK, but they're actually from Long Island, New York.
Bill Meyer here, and the reports keep coming in from listeners who have saved at Sky Park Insurance. Here's Lauren from Eagle Point.
My insurance bills kept rising over the years, so I took Bill's advice and called Steve at Sky Park. After a few short phone calls, I'm now saving over $500 a year. I even referred my daughter, too.
Sky Park is an independent agency with providers like Progressive, Safeco, Foremost, and many more. Call Steve for a quote, 261-5444, or visit skyparkins.com.
At Sky Park, we make insurance easy.
Hi, I'm Dwayne Barkley with American Rancher Garage, and I'm on KMED.
Junior Brown, American treasure. Boy, he did a great job picking a few years ago at that show at the historic Rogue Theater in Grants Pass. That was. Did you go to that show, Herman? I don't know if you saw him or not. Did you see him? Oh, my help! I brought you on. Hey, Herman, how are you doing this morning? What's that now?
Good.
Yeah.
Yep. Can you hear me now?
Yep. Okay. Can hear you now. Sorry about that.
Okay. No, I didn't go to the show. I don't have time to go to the show.
Well, I didn't either, but I tell you, I really enjoyed it. I made the time, and I'm glad I did. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, trucker country, that old style trucker country that was so much fun, really was.
Yeah, big wheels are rolling and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So anyway, Josephine County Commissioner Herman Bertschinger, and I want to talk about some accusations leveled at you recently, and this has to do with people thinking that you're not in favor of a fire district. And I'm scratching my head over that. I don't think that's true, but it still seems to get reported now and then. What's the latest on this one, Herman, and where are we?
The good old Grants Pass Daily Courier, Sunday, July 28th. I'll read this little part here. County voters have turned down repeated efforts to create a county fire district. Commissioners Herman Bertschinger and John West have both spoken against creating a fire district for Josephine County, but are also against Rural Metro being the only option for rural county residents. All right. I've been promoting a fire district since the 90s when Harold Haugen was a commissioner. And when I was in the Senate, I've got an appropriation for $1.5 million if the district is created. That appropriation is still currently sitting with the state fire marshal.
So if voters were to go for a fire district, there's a $1.5 million boost that's already sitting there waiting for it if it were to occur, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And I know this is a new reporter, Christy Ewald, and so she probably doesn't know the history. I was against the $1.74 amount, because that's the Cadillac model, and I don't think that's where we need to start, and neither does the voters. But I have been a proponent for fire districts, so I'll give Miss Ewald a pass because she's brand new. But I won't give the editor a pass because he knows better, and he reads all these stories before they go on the paper, so he should have corrected it and set the record straight.
Okay. All right. And well, maybe they will. So
I doubt it.
Okay. Here's the challenge there. Well, it's just like when they talk about a new jail in Jackson County. Everybody would like a fire district. Everyone would like a new jail. But nobody really wants to pony up the bucks to pay for it right now. And it's some of the most expensive taxpayer services that are out there right now, especially providing fire service. Is it not really, Herman?
Oh, it is horribly expensive, you know. And the other thing is the full-time firefighters. I don't think they like the volunteer firefighter system. You know, I think they're always advocating for paid firefighters. And I don't think we simply have the money. People are out of money, Bill. You just talk to people. They don't have the money to spend on things like they used to.
Then why is the unionized workforce in the fire department still continuing? I don't know if it's the fire department, but I'm talking about the fire world is making it more difficult to run volunteer fire departments. And I see the rules that keep coming down. I still know that most firefighters in this country, in the United States of America, are volunteer. But in the state of Oregon, there's always this fight to make sure that only paid firefighters are allowed to work, because there are like rules that you have to have you have to be an EMT too. You can get people to volunteer to firefight, but not necessarily to be an EMT, to be a medical tech, that kind of thing.
And it's all the training, and the rural firefighters just don't have the time to do all that training. Plus, there's an expense in that training. So, you know, but I would rather have a rural fire department that has some limited capabilities than no fire department. Okay.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, people are out of money. Congress has recognized that people are, you can't tax people anymore. That's why they haven't raised the taxes in a long time. They know we are there. They know we'll have a tax revolt if they raise them anymore. And that's why they've chose to just borrow the money, which is really another form of tax, but nobody had to vote for it, Bill.
I'm just wondering, though, at one point will the Treasury bills not catch a bid on the market? You know that? You ever worry about that?
Yeah. Right. I mean, we're living beyond our means in this country, and it's going to catch up with us. It is. We see it at the county. You know, we have a lot of folks in the county that just can't accept the fact that the county's contracting. We had $11 million less budget this year than last year, and we had somewhere between 10 and 14%. Increase the cost of doing business. And they just, I hear people in the county and, we need this. We have to have this. And I keep saying, how are you going to pay for it? And they never have an answer for that we just have to have it. So, you know, people are unhappy. And it's not just Josephine County. It's all across the country. I always call it the level of angst is what I used to refer it to. And it keeps ratcheting up. People are not happy, Bill.
Now, you also have to consider the way our counties were constituted. You know, ONC counties. Now, I imagine Joe County is an ONC county also, isn't it?
It is.
Okay. I don't know how much ONC acreage you have in Josephine County, but what used to really help keep our counties running more smoothly was the fact that there was some ONC timber revenue coming. You had not only the economic benefit of people working in the sawmills and out there on the land and fighting fires and doing other things that were part of managing forests around those days, but there was also the money that came to our counties. And, you know, we're acting as if there's no cost to just having had this kind of economic whipsaw being put on to the people of Southern Oregon, right? Isn't that a fair assessment when you think about it, the long-term consequences?
I mean, at the peak of the timber years, I call it the timber years, there was no property tax in Josephine County. They didn't need the money.
Yeah.
They had, you know, and that's why if you look at a Josephine County sheriff's emblem that they wear on their shoulder, it's a log truck. It's a log truck on a sheriff's uniform. And the reason it's a log truck is that's what paid for the sheriff's office.
I don't know. You know, maybe these days it should be a ambulance on the sheriff's department that shows them coming to pick up a doped out homeless guy over at Riverside Park. I don't know. Maybe that's what it should be.
Maybe a marijuana leaf.
Yeah, there we go. There we go.
Yeah, but here's the thing. What people don't understand is the timber era is gone.
Mm-hmm.
The demand for fiber across the world is spread out. So rewind the clock. World War One. It was over, 1919, somewhere in there. Then 25 years later, they had World War Two. And then after World War Two, they needed... And this goes back to Eisenhower and Harry Truman. They needed timber to rebuild Europe.
And so Europe got rebuilt. We, in the meantime, had great timber jobs, but that's over now, right?
That's over. And the reason we were able to ramp up so fast is we had somewhat of an infrastructure to produce the timber and get it to Europe. But now they don't need it because there's fiber everywhere on this planet. Every continent is full of fiber. So in the 40s and 50s, South America didn't have the infrastructure to get fiber to the ports and to Europe, and neither did any of the other countries. Well, they're all up, and there's so much fiber on this planet now, Bill. It's unbelievable. And then also, you know, the new types of trees that have been, you know, created and everything, like the radia pine in Australia. So they took all those grand sheep stations, which were just basically grasslands, when the wool market plummeted because of synthetic material. The wool market just dumped. There's not a wool mill in Australia anymore.
Hmm.
None. And so they planted all those massive sheep stations and these different types of pine, like radia pine. So Australia doesn't need the timber anymore. Europe doesn't need it. There's so much grown in South America. Africa is producing it. So that is what has happened. So these people, they keep saying, oh, and see, it's done. The boat has sailed. It's gone.
Okay. So, all right. And there's no support with it, with the senators either. Is there any demand for any of this fiber, though, or is the entire West Coast going to be nothing more than just burning the forest every summer and then billing the taxpayer, Herman? How do you see it?
There will always be a certain amount of demand for Douglas fir trees. The Douglas fir tree, which grows really well in British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and Northern California, that is probably the best, most diversified tree in the world. So there's always going to be a certain demand for it. But like I had a conversation, and I don't want to mention his name, but probably the largest family-owned mill in the world, who I used to talk to him all the time, and they have moved to Georgia and South Carolina and stuff, and they're moving their assets there. And he told me, he says, we build a product there that's not quite as good as what we build in Oregon, but nobody cares about the quality. So that's why they're doing that. I wouldn't say they're leaving Oregon, but they're probably investing in other places more.
Hmm. Well, people are wondering then how to pay for a fire district, how to pay for healthcare, how to pay for everything else. And yet Jackson and Josephine County, we find ourselves kind of at a crossroads, don't we? Because what is the sustainable process forward? I mean, are Jackson and Josephine County going to be little more than just accepting federal transfer payments from Social Security retirees and grant stream funding? Is that our business model over the next foreseeable future?
Well, both the counties are a little bit old. I call it older, not the county being older, but the citizens being older. So mm-hmm. There's going to be some of that. We still, 75% of the ground in Josephine County is federally owned, and we're never going to see much revenue off of that. We have to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a place, even though we have I-5, the shipping costs, getting things in and out of the Rogue Valley are pretty high compared to other places around, the country. So that's kind of where we are. That's just where we are. The Rogue Valley over in Medford, Jackson County, certainly has a lot more commerce going on, and Josephine County is kind of a bedroom community to that. But other than that, Bill, it's just, it's where we are and our situation. I remember one time I was having a discussion with Governor Brown in my office. And she's saying, well, it was over funding law enforcement. She says, well, you need to do this. You got to, you know, get it from your tax base. And I finally said, stop. I pulled this big map out behind the door and I put it up there and it showed all the land that has assessments on it for the county. And it's a small percentage. I go, everything else we don't get a penny from. And she looked at that and she goes, I never seen that.
Isn't that fascinating? That I mean, the governor agreed with you though, understood the challenge of running these old timber counties though, in which the vast majority of the county is owned by and controlled by the federal government instead of
the local authority. And then you pile on that all the private forest lands on top of that. We don't get hardly any money from them, and so I said. That's my tax base, Governor. And she just shook her head. She goes, wow, I didn't realize. I go, that's the problem. We're a natural resource county. Mining and timber was the bread and butter. Now nobody needs that anymore. And so that's where we're stuck. We're just stuck.
Uh-huh. Well, you know what Seligman's going to say, though, is that why didn't you go all in on dope?
Well, I think there's that market's kind of saturated. And as other states legalize marijuana, that's not going to help us much here either.
Okay, I guess we can't grow fentanyl on the old dope lands, can we?
No, we're not an agriculture community either. Mm. We have a very small percentage of our lands are actually agriculture. I mean, you compare take Josephine County and compare it to Illinois or Minnesota or anybody in the grain belt, you know, where the whole county, every acre is producing something. That's not here. You know, we have very small, in reality, our farming community is very small and it's mostly all now hobby farms. There's only a few dairies left and the farmlands, they're not big farms. So people have to have another job and have their farm too, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like I used to, you know, I own a ranch and I go, well, I'll just keep ranching until I run out of money. So but the ranch has never paid for the ranch. It's my other businesses that I've had over the years that have paid for the ranch.
You think anything changes as long as Fed controls so much of the area? You think anything changes until then?
No. Mm-hmm. And we have some of the highest mineral deposits in the world is right here in Southwest Oregon and Northern California. And it's all locked up. Look, at every time Wyden comes to his town hall, what's he talking about? Locking up more. No, you can't even prospect. You can't. No mineral development. No this, no that. So, you know, that's how Josephine County started, was minerals, not timber.
Speaking of Wyden, did you see that post of him the other day? Oregon's proven vote-by-mail system has set the gold standard for secure elections. Did you see that?
Well, that's looking through a Democrat lens, of course.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. Hey, what do you think about the governor wanting $1.3 billion for the homeless? Oh, and I was looking how much money they're shipping to Central Oregon, and I was just using their numbers. How many homeless and how much money? That's like $20,000 for every homeless person over there.
Yeah, $20,000. Well, $20,000 doesn't buy what it used to buy, Herman.
Oh, God. You know, Bill, when are people going to wake up? The homeless issue, climate change issue, wildfire issue, COVID issue. All of these issues are created. Or they're taking advantage. They're not. Some of them are created. Some of them are just happened. Natural disasters happen. But they use them to manipulate public opinion. It's really that simple.
And it's our fault if people are manipulated to continue to put the people who brought the problems to us and keep them in office, such as Senator Wyden. We'll just kind of leave it at that. Hey, Herman?
Oh, well, yeah. You know, I was looking at a Facebook post, and there's these four very well-known scientists that all got Nobel Peace Prizes and everything. And they were saying that, you know, climate change isn't as big an issue as people say. And so, I posted up there, you ought to see people. Oh, how about all the other scientists that are? And I said, so what do we just discount these scientists, what they say? Because you don't like what they say? You just they all got Nobel Peace Prizes. Their credentials are off the wall. And we just discount it because we don't like their opinion. So they're wrong because we don't like it.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, yeah. Herman, I'm glad we had a chance to talk as always, but keep a takeaway from this one is that Herman was not against the fire district, even though there was some reporting going on with it.
I'm still trying. In fact, I'm going to try to do some things with that here in the next couple months to see if I can't persuade my other commissioners to help a little bit. So we'll see what goes on. But I don't like a single – right now you have this one provider in Josephine County, okay?
Yep.
That's a monopoly. I don't like that, Coach. Because if I go to build a house because of the state laws, you know, we just got overturned on that, but we're not done fighting. The state law says you have to show fire protection to build a house. Well, now if I'm going to build a house and I don't live in a fire district, I have to go to a private fire provider. And if there's only one, guess what? They can charge whatever the hell they want.
There's one price. Yeah.
Yeah. So they say,
on the other hand, though, is a government fire district really competition? Because they can force you to take money. They force people to take money on their behalf.
Except the people vote in how much money they get to take. I don't get it. I don't get to vote how much a private fire company charges me. I get to vote how much a fire district charges me.
All right.
That's the difference.
All right, that's the difference. All right, Herman, we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks or more, all right? You take care.
All right, take care, Bill.
All right, be well.